would be relevant to us. She shrugged, rubbing her arms where he'd held her. He followed her action, frowning. Did I hurt you? A blush stained her cheeks, heightening her discomfort. No. She tugged her sleeves down over her wrists. It's nothing. Because she couldn't tell him the truth. I wanted to touch the place you touched me. The only way to get herself out of this was to answer his question, or at least part of it. I was upset because Rachel thought I knew who'd taken the gun. I didn't. Her mind working quickly, she added, If I had something on Max, I wouldn't keep it to myself. But he was too clever for her, and she saw him glance past her to Amadou, waiting at the end of the hall. He must have guessed the reason she hadn't asked Amadou to join them. Did you think Amadou had taken the gun, just as a precaution? She couldn't answer this. How could she? She wanted Issa's trust, but not if it came at Amadou's expense. She veiled her eyes. May I go now? He ignored that. We've flagged your name in several online discussions about the shooting, including Wolf Allegiance threads about Amadou's brother Bilal. You may have been worried about Amadou's safety. If he was the one who stole Yusuf's gun, that might have seemed reasonable to you. Conflicted, she stared up at him, hoping he would give her a little more. When he didn't, she whispered, Amadou wouldn't have vandalized our offices, not even as a smokescreen. Issa's eyes stayed on hers. Who discovered the break-in? She didn't know if it was a trap, but she answered honestly. Amadou did? Then he called me. He might have taken the gun after he discovered the damage. She tugged at her sleeves again, a nervous, betraying gesture. Struggling to find the right words, she came up with, You've seen what's happened here. You know what happened to you. Her eyes traced the bruise on his forehead. I'm not saying he did, but wouldn't it make sense that if Amadou took the gun, he took it for his own protection? The look on Issa's face was one she recognized. He'd looked at her that way once, in Waverly, on the day she'd finally learned who had killed Miraj. It was the limitless sympathy one would extend to a child. Quietly, he said, A gun has other uses, Elisa. Yusuf's was used at the mosque. Her heart shriveled up at the words. Amadou didn't do it. You're supposed to protect us from this. How could you think he's guilty of killing one of our closest friends? She waved to Amadou, shifting away from Issa. But Issa swung her back around. This time he made no apology for his touch. Where are you going? His tone warned her not to put him off. To the radio station. We still have a show to do. I thought your program airs in the morning. You shouldn't be out this late. Eliza swallowed at the look in his eyes. He thought she was lying again. Pascal is doing a special broadcast. The dean managed to get us equal time, maybe to make up for not taking action on my earlier reports. How long is the broadcast? We'll be done by midnight. You're already a target. Why do you want to provoke whoever has you in their sights? She glared at him, furious. The messenger bag on her shoulder flipped forward. He read the slogan she had printed out and taped across its flap. Hashtag, journalism is not a crime. Quietly intense, she muttered, It's not a provocation either. I'm standing up for us. I thought you'd want me to. Damn it, Eliza, I'm telling you not to do this. His grip was so tight now that it was hurting her, but Eliza didn't care. She welcomed the harshness of the contact. She relished the power she had to get under his skin like this. Her sense of triumph reached him, and he flushed, a dark color rising in his face. Her instincts at war, she said, "Well, I don't answer to you, unless you're hoping to change that." His brief laugh mocked them both. "Even if I did, you wouldn't listen to me, so don't hold it up as incentive." Aliza blinked at this. "Would it be incentive? Don't twist what I'm saying. I want you to go straight home." A sudden bleak acceptance descended on her thoughts. He was right. She had been willing to twist it. She'd seen what she wanted to see when all she had really shared with him was her love for Miraj. Not once had he indicated otherwise. Not once had he crossed that line. That look on his face in the church, it didn't mean Issa was hers or that he wanted to be. All she had to do was look at him with Seher to know the truth. A staggering pain swamped her senses, but she would never let him see it. She forced herself to speak.
"I'll go home after we've done the broadcast."
He put up a hand to the bruise at his temple and rubbed the area around it. He glanced at Constable Benoit, who was wisely pretending not to listen. "Keep a close eye on her, on both of them," he gestured at Amadou. "Make sure you see them safely home." Benoit nodded. Issa turned back to Aliza. "Don't say anything to rile up Thibaut. We didn't track him down in the raid, which is why you need to be careful." She couldn't bring herself to reassure him. She was angry in a way she knew he didn't deserve. None of this was his fault, but she needed a reason to blame him. He didn't let go when she tried to tug herself free. He waited for her to face him. When she did, he said calmly, "I know you're angry at me, but I also hope you know I'm trying to keep you alive." For a moment, her eyes were locked on his, but she couldn't, wouldn't speak. Resigned to her stubbornness, he let go of her hands with an angrily muttered curse. Aliza wished he hadn't. She wished he were holding her still. Until he said with conviction, "I wish to God I'd never met you." Chapter 68. Rachel and Khattak met up in the hallway.
"Got a call from Gaff," she told him. "He says he's come across something in the online chatter we should take a look at."
Khattak looked tired to his bones, so she added,
"I can take care of it if you want to get some rest. Seher's already at the hotel. Probably a good idea for you to check on her."
"You're sure you don't mind?" He rubbed a hand across his eyes, making her glad she'd made the offer.
"Lemaire's heading to the station."
She glanced around.
"What happened to the kids?"
"They went back to campus to do a live broadcast. Constable Benoit is with them." She whistled under her breath.
"Not a great idea, sir."
He met her gaze with perfect understanding. "Aliza doesn't listen to me." His anger sounded personal, bitter. To cheer him up, she said,
"Benoit is pretty diligent. Plus, he wants to impress you. I'm sure they'll be okay. But I'll check in from the station."
"I'd be grateful if you did. I won't be away long."
"Take until the morning, sir. You look beat."
He gave her that smile that never failed to disarm her, appreciative and a bit amazed. "You're the one who was shot. You should be taking a break." Rachel's shrug was unforced. Trying not to make too much of things, she said,
"That was more of a bee sting. Besides, I like working with Lemaire."
Lemaire was waiting for her at the exit, pointing impatiently at his watch. Grinning now, Khattak said, "I'm fairly certain Lemaire enjoys it more. Let him go ahead.
I can drop you at the station and we can catch up on the way.
She nodded, striding off to let Lemaire know. By the time Khatak had brought the car around, she'd organized her thoughts about the case. She slid into the car, checking her purse for snacks. She found a coffee crisp and a fig bar. Khatak accepted the latter, which left Rachel with the chocolate fix she'd craved.
Knock yourself out, Khatak said as the crumbs from her chocolate bar flew everywhere. For once, I don't care about the car.
Mumbling through a mouthful of chocolate, she teased. That's only because this isn't your BMW. Making quick work of her snack, she summarized the case for him.
I'm thinking what's most relevant here is what we learned from Dr. Sandston. We're looking at least two profiles, and from what I've seen, two separate cases. Your kidnapping and assault are one, the attack on the mosque is the other.
And there are the leaks. I find them confusing. They're tied to the investigation, but the messages are specific to me. Either someone's following me or they've bugged our offices.
Rachel dabbed at her lips with a tissue. Wafer crumbs fell into her lap.
Probably both, sir. But like we talked about earlier, the text messages to you fit a different profile, the profile of a stalker. The leaks to the press and to the Wolf Allegiance are coming from a separate source, someone higher up, like Lemaire.
Khatak glanced at her briefly. Not Superintendent Killiam.
Rachel considered the possibility.
Maybe. But there's a gap between events and when I'm able to update her, though I've made a few calls. Our leak is moving in real time.
They pulled up in front of the station. She stayed in the car. There was plenty more to say.
We need to consider a personal motive that's not related to you. Like Dr. Sandston said, maybe the shooting had a target. It could have been gang-related and therefore about Amadou. It could have been directed at the father with his little son, Abu Bekr, I think his name was, or at Youssef Soufiane and his mother. Or this could be a case of neo-Nazis run amok. The Wolf Allegiance has popped up everywhere except at the scene of the shooting.
Khatak opened the windows and shut off the engine. Warm air filled the car, wrapping around them both.
They're not mutually exclusive, are they? A Wolf Allegiance member like Max has a personal animus against Amadou as well.
Rachel turned to face him.
Oh yeah? What's that?
He's jealous of Amadou's closeness with Aliza.
Rachel nodded.
I'm worried about the way she ends up at the center of things.
Khatak surprised her by saying bitterly, Maybe she makes herself the center. At his unexpected burst of anger, Rachel felt like apologizing for Aliza.
They think they're indestructible at that age.
Khatak's hands gripped the wheel. Rachel could nearly hear him thinking.
She isn't, he offered at last.
It might not be about her either, Rachel said doubtfully. I know she's been a catalyst here, with her radio program and the way she challenges Thibault.
She shuddered.
God, what a little creep. But this could be about the Lilies of Anjou. They seem to be everywhere, too. And it was their involvement with Youssef and Amadou that seemed to rile everyone up. Again, it could tie in to the Allegiance. They'd hate that more than anything else.
Fatigued, Khatak rested his head on the wheel.
Except Muslims, he said quietly.
Rachel wondered if she should pat his back. Her hand hovered awkwardly before it dropped to her side. She looked up at the doors to the station and thought of Lemaire's press conference on the stairs.
We've been thinking the leak has to be highly placed, but maybe that's not the case.
Khatak raised his head and looked at her.
Who else would have that kind of information? When and where are raids going down?
Rachel mulled the answer aloud.
It could be someone with an ear to the ground, the same someone who bugged Lemaire's office, someone we think of as invisible. At the flash of unease on Khatak's face, Rachel knew he'd come to the same conclusion.
Christ, she said. He does have the necessary tech skills, and we invited him in.
I sent him off with Eliza.
Khatak turned on the car. See what Gaffney wants, then get Lemaire and meet me at the campus. Let's pray Eliza and Amadou made it to their show.
Chapter 69. Despite the lateness of the hour, the station was crowded with cops. Moving quickly, Rachel grabbed a can of pop from one of the vending machines before she found Gaff at the cubicle he shared with Philippe Benoit.
You figure out who the leak was yet? Because I have a theory I don't think you're going to like.
Gaff frowned at her. Team members were everywhere. He pulled her into the closest office, his laptop tucked under his arm. Rachel flicked on the light. She perched at the edge of the desk, which turned out to be Clément's. Luckily, her royal uptightness had clocked out for the night.
Is Dr. Sandston still here?
Gaff shook his head. She left a while ago. Lemaire dismissed all personnel who weren't involved with the raids. I think cleaning house is his priority.
Rachel nodded. I'm worried about the boss going off on his own. Does your evidence point to Benoit?
Gaffney opened his laptop to show her a single white page. This is what I've collected from a number of different online sources. There's a name that seems to recur. I noticed it because on one of these platforms there was direct engagement with Eliza Siddiqui. Her heart racing, Rachel scanned the page. The first two references were from the blog of a woman based in Montreal by the name of Elise Doucet. Flagged. Translated from the French. Edith Saussier. They are decent French boys who have been shamefully maligned. A Beautiful Mercy.
Decent French girls, too.
Elise Doucet.
In the New Quebec, everyone's a racist.
Candlelight Vigil. We need to change that. We need to change the way they talk about us. A Beautiful Mercy.
The change has already come.
Flagged. Translated from the French. Edith Saussier.
I heard the black boy was after our girls.
A Beautiful Mercy.
It's not just him, it's all of them. We should be taking action.
Roy Grenier. I don't care if that makes me sound racist. That's not something we need. There's such a thing as too much assimilation. Candlelight Vigil.
I don't care what religion someone chooses to believe in. No one should have to die while they're peacefully praying.
Elise Doucet.
All the more reason why they should have stayed out of our church and out of Saint Isidore.
A Beautiful Mercy.
They'll figure it out too late.
Rachel read the first two entries and looked at Gaff.
Okay, they're talking about Amadou, but it doesn't seem all that different from the rest of the commentary. I don't see Elise's name.
She also didn't see Benoit, and she breathed a little easier, though she was itching to be on her way. Keep reading. I've cut and pasted another section from the replies to the town council's statement on the shooting. I think ABM and A Beautiful Mercy are probably the same person given their preoccupation. Rachel scrolled down the page, squinting closely at the screen. Flagged. Translated from the French. ABM.
Nothing is the same in Quebec. What we were, what we held dear, all of that is gone. One of us had to fight back.
ABM.
Does not cry for our sons. Will not look after our daughters.
ABM.
No one's ever cared about our humanity before. If we don't stand up for who we are as Quebecois, if we don't think about the future of our daughters, we'll vanish from the pages of history.
Eliza S.
Does murdering innocent people in a mosque count as standing up for Quebecois identity? Should that be recorded in our history?
ABM.
Who said they were innocent?
Eliza S.
Your comments are appalling. What crime were they guilty of?
ABM.
The same one you are with Max. I shouldn't have to say it.
Rachel didn't get it. She looked at Gaffney, perplexed.
I don't see a theme.
He snorted. I thought you were some kind of prodigy. ABM is obsessed with the Daughters of Quebec. She keeps talking about protecting them.
Rachel paused, fitting the facts together. You think this is about the women who were killed in the basement?
Exasperated, he said, That's not who she means. Given the online chatter about Amadou, I think she means Amadou and that girl, Émilie Peladeau. You mentioned her when you told me about the Lilies of Anjou. Have you spoken to her about the shooting?
No, Rachel realized. A huge oversight on her part. She'd talked to Chloé and Réjeanne, but she'd dismissed Émilie because Amadou had dismissed her.
The lanterns on the lake that had led them to the gun. She swallowed noisily.
You think this is some kind of revenge on her part? And that's why she engaged with Elisa? Because she was jealous of her?
I don't know. I just thought it was interesting. Also, I don't think Benoit is your leak. I tracked the calls that were made to the press, and they didn't come from the station or from any of the phones registered to Lemaire's team.
You can't rule them out. They may have used a burner phone.
They didn't. They came from an actual number I was able to trace.
Wow, Rachel commented. I wasn't expecting that.
Gaff's weathered face broke into a grin. No one ever said these guys were smart.
Max? She guessed. Maxime Thibault was the one?
Which, if true, would raise additional questions. Max had no insight into their investigation or into Lemaire's raids. They were still missing a connection. She took a sip from her drink and tried to think. Wrong again. The number is from the switchboard at Pascal Richard's studio.
What?
In her excitement, Rachel spilled her drink on Clément's aggressively tidy desk. Grinning broadly, Gaff fished out a pack of tissues and handed it over. She mopped up the mess with great care, drying off the bottom of a framed photograph of a group of young people, curtailing the spill before it could reach Clément's keyboard.
He did have a swastika tattoo.
But would Richard have been so negligent as to leak information from his own phone line? She studied the photograph of Lemaire handing Pascal the key to the city with a sense of unease.
So? Gaff asked her. Does that help?
Rachel gnawed at her lower lip.
I think so. At least I should let Khatak know so he can check out for the night. He went after Benoit.
Gaffney nodded and signaled for her to call. She got Khatak on the first ring.
It's not Benoit, she told him. Elisa and Amadou are safe.
Khatak wasn't in his car. He sounded like he was walking through a large and empty building, his footsteps echoing on stone.
Where are you? She asked.
Still on the campus. Elisa and Amadou weren't at the radio station. I'm checking the MSA office now.
Rachel remembered the long, empty hallway lined with mahogany doors. This late at night, the building would be deserted, but if Elisa and Amadou weren't doing their broadcast from the campus... She made the connection quickly, her heart plummeting to her feet. She snapped her fingers at Gaffney.
Can you get Richard's broadcast on your laptop?
Gaff didn't ask why. He reached over to scoop his laptop from the desk.
Rachel, what's going on?
Khatak's voice sounded in her ear, terse and afraid. Rachel quickly filled him in. The sound of Richard's program filled the room. Rachel put her phone on speaker. But it wasn't Richard she heard debating the outcome of the raids. The voice she heard was Elisa's. Khatak swore and checked his footsteps. He'd stopped moving, but Rachel heard an echo down the hall.
Sir, I don't think you're alone there.
There was a long pause before Khatak spoke, lowering his voice.
Get over to Richard. I'll meet you there.
I'm heading over to you.
The footsteps sounded louder. "It's just Père Étienne, Rachel. It's nothing to worry about." Before she could object, Khattak cut off the call. She stared at Gaffney, wordless. "Call him back," she said, "and get Lemaire and anyone else you trust. Meet me in the parking lot." He left at once, forgetting his laptop on the desk. Frowning, Rachel reached over to grab it. When she spun it around, the page he'd saved leapt up at her from the screen. She read the transcript again. Khattak's bitter words whispered into her mind. "She makes herself the center of things." But was Aliza at the center of this crime? Almost idly, she read the words she'd failed to notice before. "Translated from the French." But if the transcript had been translated into English, she read it again, puzzled. Something niggled at the corner of her mind. She took a deep breath and closed her eyes, shifting pieces of the case around. She'd gone to the hospital with Khattak to interview Amadou Duchamp. The lounge had been crowded with people she didn't know, waiting for news on the fate of their loved ones, among them the Lilies of Anjou. But in that chaos, there had also been many officers of the Sûreté, men and women whom Khattak had called to account for failing to stand at their posts or to control the scene, and others, including Aliza. The names on the page danced up in her mind, and then not a name, but a word, a carefully chosen word. Rachel's eyes snapped open. She glanced around the office almost blindly. She focused on the word, and then she knew. She knew it all. She knew who the target at the mosque had been and why. She knew who had carried out the shooting. It made a dreadful kind of sense. Swallowing a cry of fear, she grabbed Gaffney's laptop and ran. Chapter 70. "What are you doing here, Père Étienne?" The priest was wearing his collar under a long black jacket. A bulging note case was gripped tightly under his arm. He gestured at the row of offices, his eyes deep-set and dark.
"I have a chaplaincy office here. I sometimes come here to work. I caught sight of you."
Khattak studied the other man's face. The past few days had not worn well on him. He seemed smaller, shrunken, gravely uncertain, harrowed by the experience at the church and by the murders themselves. Khattak hesitated. He couldn't afford to wait, but he wanted to hear what the priest had to say.
"Are you prepared to help me, Father?"
Père Étienne glanced back at the MSA office door. It was still sealed off, this time by professional police tape. Though without a guard at the door, anyone could slip under it to tamper with the scene. The faint scruff of Père Étienne's tonsure was disheveled, his beard roughly overgrown, his eyes red-rimmed. The secrets of the confessional had taken a toll. He couldn't seem to look away from the swastika on the MSA door.
"Père Étienne?" Issa prompted.
The priest's eyes slid to his, measuring, judging, praying for absolution. Issa gave up.
"I can't wait. I'm sorry. Aliza and Amadou are in danger."
He started down the long corridor, filled with regret. Anything Père Étienne could have told him would have helped, but as with Aliza, the gruesome realities of the shooting had sheared off a layer of his restraint.
"Wait!"
He heard a sudden thump. Père Étienne's note case had slipped from his hands, spilling his papers on the floor. Issa strode back to him, a pulse flickering at the corner of his mouth. Père Étienne bent to gather up the contents of the note case.
"My son,"
Issa handed back the pages of a hastily written sermon.
"Père Étienne, what is it? You asked me about confession."
The silence stretched out in the hall. Père Étienne gave him a name, and the name he spoke made Issa turn and run. The building in which Richard's studio was housed was dark. Issa raced up the steps to the door. He tested the handles. Locked. He'd called for backup, still minutes away. Rachel was en route, accompanied by Lemaire. His phone rang just as a text buzzed through. He took the call and ignored the text. As Rachel's terrified voice sounded in his ear, he noticed several shards of tempered glass scattered across the pavement. He looked up above the door. The outdoor lights had been shattered, as recently as this evening. He looked back the way he'd come. The parking lot was empty except for a handful of cars. One was his, the other was Benoit's patrol car. From its license plate, he was able to identify the third as Richard's. And that was it. If Richard was airing his broadcast, he was doing it with a skeleton staff. Rachel's panic was bleeding into him. He hoped he'd been right to place his faith in Benoit. They had nothing on Richard, who wore his sympathies openly. More important, from the breakdown of the image of the figure fleeing the mosque, Richard's height wasn't a match. Richard was simply too tall. Issa tried the door again, rattling the glass, Rachel's voice still chattering in his ear. "Slow down, Rachel, I can't understand your French." Rachel said it again. Her words froze him in place. Carefully, he raised his head and looked around the lot. With his free hand, he reached for his gun. But the lot was still deserted. There was no figure clad in a long, dark jacket as there had been outside the prayer at the church. He used the butt of his gun to break the glass and opened the door. He tried the elevators first, locked for the night. He ran to the stairwell that led to the third floor. "Get here," he said to Rachel. He heard her say, "2 minutes," before he shut off his phone. On the third floor, Amadou's voice filled his ears. He passed the abandoned reception desk, the hallways dark, the soft light pooled on the floor coming from the studio itself. His hand reached for a light switch. The hallway lights stayed dark. Listeners were calling in to the show. Amadou and Aliza took turns fielding the calls. At the sound of Aliza's voice, relief swamped him like a wave. And then he listened more closely, edging toward the studio in the dark. He didn't hear Richard, and he didn't think Richard would have given his broadcast into Amadou's hands, or into Aliza's, even with her experience. His hands were slick with sweat. He adjusted his grip on his gun, wishing he'd brought a flashlight. Nothing stirred in the hallway. He could make out the shapes of desks and chairs, and on one side a bank of cabinets. He checked quickly, but no one was hiding on the far side. He moved forward a step and tripped over something he hadn't noticed. He looked down at his feet. A faceless mass was huddled there. He turned it over with his foot, bringing out his cell phone and using its light to see. The silent mass was Philippe Benoit. He was bleeding from a wound on his head, his gun missing from its holster. Khattak knelt down beside him, testing for his pulse, his own heart kicking up speed. He hit Rachel's number with his thumb just as a shape loomed out of the darkness and threw itself at him. He dropped his phone and rolled aside. His assailant leapt at him again. Khattak stuck out his leg and tripped him. He landed a foot away, cold black metal sliding across the floor. Khattak holstered his own gun swiftly, wrestling with the strong, dark shape. They thrashed across the floor. Khattak gained a little traction and threw his attacker aside. Whoever it was, he landed next to Benoit, knocking himself out when his head thumped hard against the floor. Khattak pinned his body to the floor, resting his arms behind his back. He heard the clink of metal, then a weak voice spoke in his ear. "Would these help?" Benoit had managed to raise his head. He was holding his handcuffs in his hand. Khattak used them to lock down the suspect. He turned the suspect over as Benoit whispered, "I'm sorry. He jumped me when I went to check the lights." Khattak put a finger to his lips.
Can you get up?
Benoit shook his head, then groaned.
I don't think so.
Khattak looked down at the suspect he'd just handcuffed. He recognized Pascal Richard's intern, André Martin, the young man who served as a military cadet, the one he'd accused of looking like one of Maxime's disciples. André Martin was the name Père Étienne had given him.
He's the one who jumped you and took your gun.
Benoit nodded.
Yes.
Khattak searched for Benoit's gun. He couldn't find it. He'd lost it along with his phone.
Phone,
he whispered to Benoit. Benoit passed his over, and Khattak switched on its light. He swept the floor, the hallway, the corners of the reception area. The gun was 10 feet away. He eased over to it and picked it up. He checked it. It was loaded. He gave it back to Benoit. Something glinted in the light from Benoit's phone. Khattak turned to look. The light had silvered across the buckle on André's belt. Khattak read its engraving to himself. Flay all the players. He recognized the name from a Wolf Allegiance transcript, but it didn't make sense in light of Rachel's warning. From Benoit's expression, he recognized the name as well.
Backup will be here any minute, Issa promised. Don't take your eyes off him.
Benoit nodded at him wearily. Issa squeezed his shoulder and moved on. He'd cleared the area behind him. He was in the passageway between Richard's office and the door to the studio. The on-air sign that should have warned him not to interrupt the broadcast wasn't on. He put his hand on the handle and considered. Was the broadcast actually airing, or had it been a ruse to draw Aliza and Amadou to the studio? He couldn't hear Richard's voice, but the calls coming in were real enough. Carefully, he opened the door. When he pushed it wide, he caught sight of Richard in the control booth at the back of the right side of the spacious room. With his headphones on, Richard was carefully screening calls at a soundboard, in lieu of his regular technician. He still had access to a microphone that was presently switched off. Khattak guessed that Richard had wanted to control every aspect of this particular program and would weigh in when he wanted to shift the discussion in a particular direction. The booth was protected by a glass partition, but Richard was clearly visible behind it. On the left side of the studio, several feet away from the floor-to-ceiling windows, Amadou's back was to Khattak at the large and durable host's desk, which had been set up with two microphones. He was answering a call that Richard had directed to him, a disturbingly venomous outpouring, if what Issa could hear was anything to judge by. Aliza was facing Khattak from the opposite desk at a second microphone, a digital clock to the side counting down the time in red. Aliza looked up at Issa. Her eyes went wide at the sight of the gun poised in his hand. Issa put a finger to his lips. He motioned to Aliza to drop down behind the desk. The minute she did, he scanned the studio. There was no one else in the room. Behind the glass partition, Richard caught sight of him. Shocked, he made a move to pull off his headphones, but Issa stayed him, motioning him down. Richard's hand moved suddenly, cutting off all sound. The studio was filled with dead air. Uncertain now, Issa moved so that he was between Richard and Amadou, who still hadn't turned around. Amadou remained oddly still. The lights in the studio were dim, but Amadou was staring straight ahead, his gaze fixed at a point on the picture window. A single shot shattered the glass. Aliza stifled a scream, and then there was another presence in the room. Chapter 71.
Too little, she said. Too little, far too late.
Isabel.
Issa kept his gun trained on her, just as the lethal black weapon in her hand was pointed straight at his heart. He recognized the gun. It was a Glock 19, a gun commonly used by law enforcement. If she'd fired one round to shatter the window before she'd climbed inside from the terrace, she still had more than enough ammunition. He moved closer to her cautiously. He wanted to shove Amadou behind him, but he still wasn't sure about Richard.
"Amadou, get under the desk," he urged.
"He moves and he dies," she warned. "I came here for him, after all."
"You can't get away with this, Isabel. Lemaire is already here."
He could hear the sirens at a distance. He knew it would soon be true. Her tone became lightly mocking.
"Not in time to save you, I'm afraid."
"Isabel!"
Richard squawked a protest. Issa kept his eye on Aliza, who was far too close to Isabel's side of the desk to give him any peace. Isabel glanced behind him at Richard.
"Pascal."
"What the hell are you doing?"
She shifted the gun so that it pointed at Richard, for whom the glass partition would provide little protection. Issa inched closer to Amadou.
"I gave you the key to the city for a reason, but to you it was only sport. Still, you served your purpose in the end."
She nodded to herself, her blonde hair spilling out in waves from under her cap. She yanked it off. She was dressed entirely in black, and she moved with the same controlled litheness as the figure he'd seen on the tape. Issa took another step closer to Amadou, who still hadn't shifted to the side. His hands were clenched on the desk. He wouldn't be easy to move out of the way if the opportunity came.
"What purpose?"
Khattak asked. His gun was still trained on Isabel, his arm locked firmly in place.
"Stirring up the people of this town, riling up all of Quebec, especially those like André Martin and Maxime Thibault. It was so easy in the end. But you..."
The gun now shifted back to Khattak. Her pale eyes glinted with triumph.
"You were slow to catch on."
From the corner of his eye, he saw that Aliza had moved farther under the desk, easing closer to Amadou. His tone conversational. Issa responded,
"How could I? The texts you sent me were from an encrypted source, and you didn't say a word when you had me at your mercy."
She frowned at him.
"What texts? This is the first time I've had you at my mercy."
He played along. "Then how was I supposed to guess?" But Rachel had guessed. Rachel's sharp mind had put it all together.
"Who else could have been the leak? Who else do you know who had access to the footage of the woman in the abaya at the scene of the shooting? I didn't leak it myself. I put it in André's hands, just as I had Pascal hire him as a personal favor to me."
Wheezing a little, Pascal drew his attention to her, his voice clearly audible from behind the glass.
"You're the head of the allegiance? You're the one who hit the mosque?"
Khattak's free hand moved to Amadou's shoulder. He pressed hard, letting him know what he wanted.
"No,"
Isabel said sharply.
"He's the one I want. You won't be able to save him."
"Why, Isabel? What has Amadou ever done?"
With a sudden move, she switched her gun to her other hand.
"Because he nearly saved him," she said coolly. "That's why he has to pay."
Issa shook his head, miming confusion. His arm had begun to stiffen, but he could hear the sound of police cars speeding into the lot.
"Saved who, Isabel? I don't know who you mean."
"Youssef. All my hard work, all my careful planning. He nearly saved Youssef's life."
"Why would that matter?"
A droplet of sweat formed on his forehead and slid into his eye. He blinked rapidly, trying not to lose sight of where her gun was aimed. But he'd pushed her too far. She took three steps forward, pressed her gun to Amadou's head, and spit the words in his face.
"Because Chloé Villeneuve is my niece,
and Sufyan polluted her. He and his mother both, the one who told him to marry her.
Amadou gasped at the feel of the gun against his temple. Aliza's involuntary movement struck a jarring note in the silence.
There's time enough for Aliza.
Issa struggled to quash his sense of panic. There isn't, he tried to say calmly. You can't escape, even if you make it out. Listen to me, Isabel. You don't need Aliza or Amadou. You need a high-profile hostage. Keep me and let the others go.
She tipped her head to one side, her blonde hair obscuring her face.
No, she said quite coolly, although you are a high-value target.
She moved her gun from Amadou's head and pressed it against Issa's chest. She used it to draw two lines against his chest, and he realized she'd marked him with a cross.
If I killed you because of who you are, it would show the rest of you that none of you are safe. And after you, Diana Shahada, perhaps.
Fine, he said carefully. I accept your terms. Make your point with me. The others are insignificant. They'll be forgotten as quickly as the people you killed at the mosque.
Issa, no!
Aliza scrambled out from under the desk. Isabel swung around to point the gun at her, in the process jolting Issa's arm. His gun was knocked from his hand. Quicker to react than he, Isabel scooped it up. She held herself out of his reach. With one hand, she cradled her gun to her chest. With the other, she aimed at Aliza. His face went white, and she laughed.
How perfect it would be if I killed her with your gun. How poetic. Just as I killed Yusuf with the gun he bought for protection. What a mercy I spared him the AR-15. A beautiful mercy, in fact.
No. Issa couldn't breathe. He knew this moment. He'd seen it in his nightmares. He knew when a suspect was poised on the brink of a desperate act. Isabel, this isn't the way. He heard the pounding of footsteps up the stairs, the shouts as Benoit and Martin were discovered, but the sound was hollow in his ears, a lifetime away, a distance he couldn't bridge, and the last thing he'd said to Aliza was something he'd never be able to retract.
It's the only way.
Amadou shouted hoarsely to distract her, but all Issa heard was the shot. The sound shattered the night. Issa shivered with terror, frozen in place, but absurdly, the sound he heard in his mind was the melody in the woods. Tinny, haunting, cold as Aliza would be. Chapter 72.
Sir, are you all right?
He felt himself shaken roughly, Rachel's voice in his ears.
Issa!
She shook him again until he focused. He noticed the bits of broken glass on her shirt. Her arm was bleeding from a scratch. She'd hurt herself, somehow. He couldn't look past her. Wouldn't. She reached up and murmured in his ear.
It was a clean shot. She'll be okay. Until she ends up in prison.
And then he dared to look over at the window, where Aliza was leaning weakly against the wall, Amadou beside her. Isabel Clément had fallen at his feet. Lemaire's team took over, and he and Rachel were ushered from the room, along with Pascal Richard. Lemaire stood in the center of the chaos, pulling it all into order, the role that was usually Khattak's. Issa grabbed Rachel's hand.
You shot her?
With a cocky grin that didn't fool him, she answered,
from the window, a nice clean shot to the shoulder before she could make up her mind.
How did you know she was here?
She jerked her head at Richard. When our friendly neighborhood Nazi turned off the sound in the studio, he switched on the speakers outside.
Lemaire came up the stairs. I made my entrance from the back. She gave him a crooked smile. Saved your bacon is what I did. Course, that might matter more if bacon was actually your thing. A hoarse laugh sounded from his throat.
Believe me, Rachel, it matters.
We're even now, right? She said warily. Me on the ice, you here? Issa shook his head with the ghost of a smile. The inroads Rachel had made into his heart still had the power to surprise him.
No, he said firmly. You still have the upper hand.
Aliza was perched on a desk in the hallway. A female officer took her statement while Amadou hovered close by. Issa stopped to speak to him, console him, but in the end it was Amadou who had wisdom to share. Perhaps wisdom he'd gained through the process of losing his brother.
He watches over you, he said. He watches over me. And even if I had found myself with Yusuf, I would only be closer to him.
Amadou was taken aside by the officer waiting to debrief him. When Issa reached Aliza, she had finished giving her statement. She looked up at him, shivering, a question in her eyes. He gathered her up from the desk and hugged her as fiercely as he could.
What I said to you was unforgivable. It would have been the last thing you remembered.
She pulled back a little and smiled at him through her tears.
No,
she contradicted him.
What I would have remembered is the way you begged Isabel to take your life instead of mine.
He swallowed, knowing what she would say.
Aliza, I love you, Issa. I have for a long time now.
He couldn't think of an answer, but after a moment he said,
You know I'm marrying Seher. All I have to give you is this.
He knew she'd understand, even if he didn't have the words. With a faint smile of surprise, she whispered,
Anything you give me is enough.
Chapter 73. They had gathered to brief Superintendent Killiam on the arrest of Isabelle Clément. Khattak had appropriately given Rachel the credit for the break in the case, and following his lead, Lemaire had ceded the floor. The nature of Rachel and Khattak's partnership became clear. Rachel spoke freely, occasionally checking with Khattak, who either nodded or added a few words of his own. He didn't interrupt unless Rachel asked for his thoughts. It was Sergeant Gaffney who spotted it, Rachel was saying modestly. He brought me the transcript, and when I translated it back into French, I realized that A Beautiful Mercy was an unimaginative restyling of Isabelle Clément's name. Clément, merciful, Belle, beautiful. And if ABM and A Beautiful Mercy were the same anonymous commenter, they were both preoccupied with the Daughters of Quebec. Each of them pushed for action. I mean, plenty of others did as well, but when Gaff ran his check, Isabelle was in Montreal on the days she posted her comments on the Montreal blog. She's a white supremacist, Killiam clarified. The worst kind of Quebec nationalist. Rachel glanced over at Lemaire, blushing at the reminder of her mistake. And her name was how you made the connection? Well, that, and I knocked my can of pop over on Clément's desk. There was a photograph on her desk. I cleaned up the frame, but didn't really notice it at first. But after I made the connection, I looked again. That's when I noticed that Chloé Villeneuve was in it. And Chloé Villeneuve is her niece. Almost apologetically, Rachel said, Inspector Lemaire did tell us almost right from the beginning that the reason Isabelle came to Saint-Isidore so often was because she had family here. As for the rest, Rachel nodded politely at Dr. Sandston.
She reached behind her and snagged the remote for the blinds, using it to let a little light into the room.
Dr. Sandston is better equipped than I am to fill you in on the rest.
Marlise Sandston edged forward in her seat, the light gilding the warm, dark tones of her skin and glossing over her cheekbones. There were two shooters at the mosque. That much was clear to me when I crafted the profile, just as it was clear that one mind directed the shooting and most likely directed the activities of the Wolf Allegiance. The motive was simply rage, rage that Soufiane's family had rejected her niece Chloe, a pure laine Quebecois girl. Her deeply black eyes were knowing when she added, "It's funny, isn't it, when the shoe is on the other foot, when the despised group disapproves of members of the comfortable majority?" She drew a steady breath. Then, Youssef Soufiane's biological mother did approve of Youssef and Chloe's match. Along with Père Etienne, she took part in their marriage ceremony. This was a bridge too far for someone of Isabelle's convictions. She wanted to punish Youssef for daring to cross that divide. No doubt she had his gun stolen from campus by a member of the Allegiance. Chloe may have told her that he'd bought a gun for protection, and Isabelle might have thought it was poetic to kill Youssef with his own gun, a cold, clear execution.
"Yes," Khattak put in. "That's more or less what she said at the studio."
"But the frenzied shooting in the prayer hall doesn't fit your profile, Dr. Sandston," Killiam observed. "She would have given the AR-15 to one of her disciples."
"In this case, André Martin, who worked for Pascal Richard. He's admitted to pushing Rachel at the church,"
Lemaire added.
"As for Isabelle, we knew she was a defense attorney before she came on board as the premier's press liaison. We knew her firm was involved in Michel Gagnon's defense. Her criminal clientele included members of his gang. I should never have overlooked her. Otherwise, I would have considered what she might have gained in exchange for representing Gagnon. She would have had access to her choice of weapons."
He gestured for Dr. Sandston to continue. She gave him a gracious nod. Isabelle carried out the executions. André Martin was just another angry young man who found his voice with a gun, a profile we're all familiar with. We shouldn't have missed this, but given that the inset team was infiltrated by members of the Allegiance, it's likely that his background check was altered, sanitized for our benefit by someone on the inside. And note how this ties into the fact that other than Inspector Lemaire, who was relentlessly thorough in tracking supremacist infiltration of law enforcement in his province, we haven't been paying enough attention to the radicalization of white men from relatively privileged groups. They're being co-opted into identitarian groups, and this is a phenomenon we should be keeping track of.
Killiam nodded to herself.
"That leaves the lily on Youssef Soufiane's back." Dr. Sandston took a moment to think this over. Finally, she said, "Isabelle, again, I'm sure the knife will be recovered during a search of either her home or her temporary accommodation in Saint Isidore. It would be dear to her," she explained, "as the means by which she left her calling card. As Inspector Khattak advised me, Youssef had asked Chloe to have the tattoo of the fleur-de-lis on her wrist removed. The symbolism is remarkable."
Killiam's gray eyes were sharp and intent. Sandston continued.
"A Quebecois Muslim man of Moroccan ancestry asking a Quebecois Catholic woman to literally erase a symbol of her identity to accord with his own religious preference. When Isabelle carved the lily on Youssef's back, she was taking that on."
Killiam sighed. She adjusted her glasses, rubbing the tip of her nose.
"Terrible. What about the gun at the lake?"
Lemaire answered this. "Martin has confessed that Isabelle asked him to plant it at the lake because that was where Chloe's marriage ceremony took place. It was her way of rejecting the marriage and of pointing the finger in another direction. Réjean says she saw it there the night after the shooting. She waited too long to tell us.
She couldn't tell who was aligned with the Allegiance because there was no official response to complaints about the acts of vandalism she must have attributed to the wolves. It says something that, in the end, Inspector Khattak was the one she decided to trust. A fair enough summary, but Rachel was following her own train of thought. She looked over at Lemaire with a challenge in her eyes, but when she spoke, she chose her words with care. I'm wondering if Isabel did anything to give herself away in your meetings. Lemaire must have spent some time retracing their private conversations.
Nothing at all. She elicited my sympathy, in fact, by letting me know she was a mouthpiece for the premier and didn't have any real power in her hands. She was used to being overlooked, disrespected even as a woman.
Khattak nodded his agreement. That's also what she did with me, so I wanted to be sure that nothing I said or did gave her the same impression. Martine Killiam grimaced. Clever. Given how gender politics have been shaking up the force, she disarmed you both at the start. A small smile edged her lips as she considered Rachel. And you, she probably didn't like. Rachel grinned. I tend to have that effect. As Khattak started to demur, Rachel laughed outright, easing the tension in the room. Full of restless energy, Lemaire stood up and paced the room.
I confided in her more than I would have done otherwise, to show her that respect. That's how she was able to leak so much about the case.
Taking over from Dr. Sandston, he summarized his operation as concisely as Rachel had, and when he'd finished, Killiam concluded, Inspector Khattak isn't the only one to have a target on his back. Your actions will not be popular, I'm afraid. Lemaire shrugged without any attempt at bravado.
This is better for the SQ, better for Quebec. Let's see what happens next.
At least the Premier has seen fit to give you a commendation. Lemaire ducked his head, a little embarrassed.
At first, I thought he may have been another plant, maybe hand-picked by Isabel.
I'm surprised that Richard wasn't, given all his on-air opinions.
He's mainly an opportunist. He doesn't much care how he makes his money.
The swastika on his neck would seem to suggest otherwise, Killiam cautioned.
He used it as an entree into a select group, but we'll be going through every utterance on his program. If there's a way to charge him, we'll find it.
And this, Amadou? Killiam asked. And Aliza, Siddiqui, whom we ignored for so long, is there a hit on them?
No, nothing official. Gagnon's gang is not involved. This was all Isabel. But there's no way of predicting what radicalized young men will do. I should have paid more attention to those incidents she reported. She tried so hard to get them on my radar, but I refused to expand my focus from my operation. I thought I had room to maneuver.
A failure shared by them all. What about Maxime Thibault? Killiam asked. How will you make sure now that he stays away from Amadou and Aliza?
Lemaire spread his hands. If he's convicted of inciting hate as the founder of his chapter of the Allegiance, that will keep him away. But if those charges don't stick, unless he directly threatens them with violence, there's not much more we can do.
We'll make them stick, Killiam said grimly. But until this dies down, Aliza and Amadou should be keeping a lower profile, as a matter of their own safety. Khattak shook his head, the purple bruise on his forehead standing out in sharp relief against his paler skin. Aliza won't be quiet. You should expect more trouble from her in the days to come. Disturbed by this, Killiam said, Of the kind you suffered? How did Isabel Clément pull off the attack on you? Khattak looked quickly at Dr. Sandston.
She denied it. She also denied sending me the texts.
Lemaire leaned against the conference room table.
Rachel watched him closely, holding her breath.
By the time you were assaulted that night, Isabelle Clément had returned to Montreal.
André Martin, then, Killiam offered.
Lemaire shook his head. He had checked in with Pascal. He was at the studio all night.
Killiam frowned. Then we've missed someone else they roped in to do their work, and there will be others who infiltrated the investigation, the ones we still haven't caught. Keep at it until you find them.
Ma'am,
Rachel said to Killiam.
Mind if I have a private word with Inspector Khattak? Can you finish up here?
The superintendent nodded. Rachel turned to wink at Lemaire before she left. He smiled back at her and went on with his report. Rachel led Khattak down to the cafeteria, where in short order she found herself in possession of an inventive take on what should have been an appetizing serving of poutine. It was garnished with cilantro and lime, and gamely Rachel dug in. Khattak asked for tea, but when it came, he grimaced at its flavor and pushed his paper cup aside. In the windowless room in the basement cafeteria, he studied Rachel's face, reading the concern she no longer bothered to hide.
I'm all right, he told her, and then teasing her, he added, and you're more than all right, it would seem.
Rachel admonished him between oversized bites of her meal.
How does you being stalked add up to feeling all right?
She shoved the bowl of poutine at him. He refused it with a show of horror.
I get it. She waved a hand at his face. You don't want to mess with the pretty.
She felt like she'd scored when he laughed.
Your compliments, Rachel.
He was grinning as he shook his head, which made her all the more reluctant to bring up what was on her mind. She took a breath and a healthy bite of poutine and plunged in.
You leaving me on my own, sir? Heading on to greener pastures, like you said?
His grin faded. He reached for his tea but didn't drink it. A long silence fell, during which Rachel could hear herself chewing. But the poutine had lost its greasy appeal. She pushed it aside, depressed. When he still didn't speak, she said on a sigh,
You don't have to apologize.
She waved her plastic fork, meaning to indicate all of Saint Isidore.
After what happened here, I get it. I mean, I get what I can never get. God, I'm not making any sense.
She cleared her throat and tried again, liking the way his eyes warmed up at her efforts.
I'm not you. I can't walk in your shoes. I don't know what it's like to sit in a room full of senior officers and hear them talk about anti-Muslim activists. Would we say anti-Jewish activists and think that was okay? Or anti-Québécois?
She shook her head wisely.
We'd never say that. We'd think it was a crime.
Her fork clattered to the table.
So I get why you have to go. You have bigger battles to fight.
She blinked back sudden tears.
I'll just miss you, is all.
And then, more brashly, to make up for her tears,
Here's a compliment for you, sir. I can't say you slowed me down.
He laughed again, the sound gentler, warmer. Then he reached across the table for one of her hands. He cupped his hand around hers, and Rachel swallowed.
You do deserve a promotion, he said. But it won't be at my expense.
Superintendent Killiam has decided to expand my role to allow me greater latitude in investigations like these. I won't be as constrained, and I will be allowed to say whatever is on my mind. I'll be acting as an advisor on the threat posed by groups like the Wolf Allegiance. But my bread and butter, my first love, he said with the warmest smile and a quick squeeze of her hand, will still be working with you. If you won't mind those times you find me slow to catch on. She gripped his hand with hers, grinning at him like a fool. In an offhand voice, she said,
"I'll do what I can, sir. One of these days you'll catch up."
They smiled at each other like the old and steadfast friends that they were. Then Khattak reached into his pocket and drew out the envelope Rachel had given him. He passed the envelope back to her. She nodded, knowing where this was going.
"Tom Paley," she said. "We weren't able to sort out why his photograph was included with the rest. And if this isn't about Isabel and everything that happened here, we need to take another look at how Paley died and whether there's something more to it."
Khattak nodded too. "Yes, agreed. But there's something else as well." Rachel sifted through the photographs again, concentrating.
"What's that, sir?"
His long fingers drew out the photograph that still embarrassed Rachel, the photograph from Algonquin, where she'd lain on the ice in his arms. "I want you to keep this photograph of us." She looked up at him with a blush, but his gaze was steady and sure.
"Yeah?"
"Yes," he said firmly. "With everything that's happened, everything that could happen, I want you to remember. I want you to know that every moment was worth it." This time, when her tears fell, Rachel really didn't give a damn. She didn't even bother to wipe her tears away. She looked at him and said,
"You need to know something, too."
He waited, watching her with that look. Amazement, appreciation, gratitude, the way no one else had ever looked at her. She slipped the photograph into her pocket and leaned closer to kiss him on the cheek. She murmured into his ear,
"You're the best friend I've ever had."
Epilogue. Seher reached out to snag the envelope that was wedged under the screen door of her home in Toronto. It was hand-stitched on exquisitely marbled paper, her name typed on its surface in a sophisticated font. She took it inside and placed it on the writing desk in the hallway. The envelope was so delicate, it couldn't be torn across. She used a letter opener to slice it at the seam instead. At first, she thought the envelope was empty, but when she shook it lightly, a photograph came loose. It fell onto her desk. Curious, she flipped it over. The photograph was of Isa. Aliza was wrapped in his arms, her face half hidden in his chest. His face was turned toward the camera, and on it was an expression that Seher had never seen, a fierce kind of tenderness, and something deeper still. For a moment, she clutched at the desk. She still hadn't gathered herself when a hand knocked at her door. She could see Isa's silhouette through the glass, but she couldn't force herself to move. "Seher?" Isa called to her. She knew he could see her. When she didn't speak, he said her name again, this time his voice grave and deep, puzzled and a little afraid. But Seher didn't answer. She left him waiting at the door. Isa took out his phone to call her. A message appeared on the screen, accompanied by a photograph of him standing at Seher's door. He flattened himself against the door, his sharp eyes canvassing the street. The leafy Toronto neighborhood was quiet, but the menace that had begun in Saint-Isidore had reached out to touch him again. Someone was still following him, close enough to observe his every action, close enough to take out a camera and point it at him like a gun. He skipped over the photograph to read the message again, the sour taste of fear in his mouth. "I hope you enjoyed the first act."
This is Peter Ganim. We hope you've enjoyed A Deadly Divide, a Macmillan audio production from Minotaur Books. This program was produced by Maddie Argyropoulos. Text copyright 2019 by Usma Zahanet Khan. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.